case is 99, 1866, disciplinary counsel versus Paul Wallace.
Pattern. It just, you know, I just had this lapse or whatever.
The board obviously is applying, it seems to be applying its recommendations, applying Powerball. If there's a pattern of deceit or dishonesty with the client or a court, you're going to sit out some period of time. You're not going to get a stay suspension. Now tell me why your client here should not have to sit out of the practice for 6 months and recommend it when you view his conduct.
Basically, Your Honor, as I said, we stipulated to that specific violation. There was also an additional violation alleged of neglect, which the panel did not find against the respondent in this case, nor did the board find against the respondent based upon the evidence. So that case, that count was also dismissed. In spite of that, the panel found, and I think the reason for us being here is that in spite of the motion to dismiss and the misstatement to the client, which was in the October 94 letter from Mr. Wallace to his client, he continued to work on that particular case even after the case was dismissed for the client, making trips to Cleveland, conducting extensive research, trying to find a way around the merits argument that he had already lost on. In addition to that, I think that they found four other mitigating factors, and I think that serves, that's the basis for the proposition of law that we asserted in our brief in support, Your Honor, that the court, we would suggest the court adopt as to indicate that they do intend to follow the law, but in the cases where the actual conduct is less than is an isolated incident, does not amount to a course of conduct, and where there's appropriate mitigating factors exist, in addition to the fact that the respondent continued to work on his client's case. He's been practicing, well, as of this year, approximately 20 years. He had no prior involvement whatsoever with the disciplinary process. The allegations originally alleged, and probably part of the reason we were before the panel on such a serious offense, was that Mr. Wall supposedly had not refunded the client's retainer to him or monies paid to him. And when it came to light, he had done that through a Visa check that he had to trace back through the bank and obtain the original check. Once that he was able to document that, we don't know where the original allegation came that he had not refunded the money to the client, but he had refunded it to him at the penal found, Your Honor, immediately upon the client asking for the money back. It wasn't like he tried to cheat the client out of any of the funds or claim that he'd done work and was still owed money for it. He kept none of the client's money.
He was not in a very good position to keep his client's money. He wasn't when the case got dismissed and he lied to him consistently about it. It's good that he returned the money, but frankly, that's no more than he should have done long ago.
I understand. As soon as the client confronted him, he was still investigating at that time, Your Honor, as he testified, and as the only evidence produced that the hearing indicated, he was still trying to find a way to reinitiate that case in the district court. But when the client found out it had been dismissed and then asked him for his money back, that's when he immediately gave it back and didn't try to say, let me keep this, let me try to refile this for you and bring this back up. In addition to that, as I indicated, in the first instance, this should not be an ultimate factor in any case, Your Honor, but there was no prejudice to the client. The client had already lost the case before coming to Mr. Wallace, so to speak. This was a novel theory that Mr. Wallace was pursuing on. And in effect, the avenues open to the client were the same after the involved Mr. Wallace as they were before him.
Was it in the statute of limitations, Ron?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence the statute ran at all in the case.
What's the reference in the relator's brief to the fact that the statute of limitations ran? Is that something different?
Your Honor, I don't know. There was no evidence to do the hearing that I'm aware of. The statute had run back at the time that Mr. Wallace terminated his relationship with the client. It had not. He specifically testified that it had not run. There was no evidence to contradict that. And I'm not aware of what the relevant statute would be in that case since it was filed a contract as the basis of the bank, whether it would be the state 15-year statute or what it would be. So I believe there is no evidence of any prejudice to the client in this case to get all of his funds back, except for the delay, of course, necessitated in the case. The panel also found in his favor that his poor judgment in not disclosing the dismissal to the client, even if he mailed the motion to the client, not actually disclosing to the client the dismissal and misrepresenting it to him in October, was motivated by his overzealousness in trying to achieve a result for the client. The board completely adopted all the panel's findings with respect to the factual allegation, so I don't believe that there's any dispute among anyone with respect to any of those facts. As I said, since Bowerball, this court, who has been a violation of BR 110284, has in several instances not imposed an actual suspension. Even in a case of Cincinnati Bar versus Reisenfeld, where the attorney in that case, according to the facts, actually lied to the court, domestic court in that case, filed a false affidavit and added allegations to a domestic affidavit that the client had not signed and sworn to under oath. There was some problems with respect to the representations of the notary in that case. In Cincinnati versus the Bar Association, no, Cincinnati case versus Hobie, H-O-B-E-Y, which we refer to in the brief. In that case, the lawyer misrepresented to a client an investment that he was trying to get the client to invest in, did not disclose his involvement in the case, and kept that secret from the client. Basically, in that case also, the court imposed a six-month suspension, but the entire 6 months was stayed. In Bowerball, the case which the court is referring to earlier, the attorney not only lied to the client, but he drew up fabricated documents that he attempted to impose upon the client, all for his self-serving motivations, trying to cover up his tracks, not trying to do anything for the client. And in fact, the client lost, I believe, a residence or something to a foreclosure in that action due to the attorney's blood. I just point out to the court that I believe the court's position in the Bowerball decision is fairly clear, but I believe that the proposition of law that we recited to the court will allow the court to decide these on a case-by-case basis where they don't find the specific requirements that the court announced in Bowerball to apply. Just request some time to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Gunner.
May it please the court, I'm Ken Donchess, one of the assistant disciplinary counselors. Let me clear up just a couple of things that Mr. Gunner said. The pattern of misrepresentation is present in this case. It's actually very simple to see, and I'll lay it out for you. On December 6th of 1993, respondent filed a complaint on behalf of the Benedicts. And he told the Benedicts that the reason he was filing a complaint was because it was the only way that he could save their house from foreclosure. We were tied up in litigation, and the title could not transfer because it was the subject of litigation. They accepted that goal, they gave permission to file, and they filed the case. On December 28, 1993, RTCE filed a motion to dismiss, and they based the motion to dismiss on the fact that they were not properly served, that the service won the wrong address. That motion went unopposed. There was no essential response to it. The Benedicts were never advised of it. They were never consulted on the strategy. And on February 10, 1994, the motion was granted, and the case was dismissed. The Benedicts were never told that motion to dismiss. They were never told that their house could now be sold, that the title was not tied into litigation, that the goal of hiring Mr. Wallace, the goal of the litigation was now lost, instead. And then we have all the correspondence. On July 12, 1994, respondent writes a letter to the Benedicts. And he says, there has been little or no progress in getting a response out of Resolution Trust for their counsel. We're going to move through the court process. I will push forward with the litigation and try to get this matter set up for hearing. On August 3rd, 1994, he writes another letter to them, and he talks about the long, ugly, uphill court battle that they're facing. He still doesn't tell them that their motion, or the motion to dismiss has been granted. He tells them that their case is the most important matter in this office, and the appropriate amount of time is being spent on it. The next day, he writes them another letter. And he says, enclosed, please find an amended complaint against Resolution Trust Corporation. corporation. We're attempting to add another plaintiff, and we're attempting to push forward with the litigation. This forces the case to stay in court, even if RTC is successful in a statutory cause of action against you. On October 4th, 1994, he writes a memo, and that's when he wrote to Judge Sam Bell some scheduling problems, and he told them that there will be upcoming hearings on jurisdictional issues. That is the pattern of misrepresentations. When you look at respondent's testimony and cross-examination, he admits, and the Benedicts also support this in Mr. Benedict's testimony, that they were having constant weekly conversations during this entire 14-week period. And in none of those communications did he ever tell them that their case had been dismissed, that the house was being transferred, that new people had moved into that house, and that there was no hope of ever getting the house back. And that is the only goal of the litigation. So the pattern is there. The pattern is very clear. When he uses the language like mending the complaint, adding a plaintiff, forcing the case to stay in court. There was nothing in court. The kids were gone.
When the house apparently was sold, right? What did the Benedicts think when their house was sold? Did they know it was sold? Or what was the timing of that? That happened during the representation. I assume after the case was dismissed, the house was then sold. What did they ask? You know, that was the reason they hired Mr. Wallace.
At that point, I believe that occurred in May of 1994, if I remember the record correctly. The Benedicts and Mr. Wallace went to the house and looked at it. And Benedicts had been asked to vacate the house earlier when the original foreclosure action was granted. So they weren't living in the house at the time. At that point, they had a conversation with Mr. Wallace about the new people moving in and what they were going to do. And Mr. Wallace told them not to worry, that he would put the rats back in the wall and he would take care of this. And he talked about maybe changing the theory of the case a little bit. But he assured them that they were pressing on the court case and this would all be resolved through the court case. At that time, the court case had already been dismissed.
In connection with other cases, like, for instance, a plan or similar acts in the criminal code, we talk about a pattern of conduct. Ergo, isn't that more than one incident?
Yes.
You are attempting or establishing a pattern all confined within one case. Is that what Fireball means, or does the pattern mean you have a pattern of doing this, of lying to judges and lying to clients? More than one.
I think it could go either way, actually. In this case, we have a 13-month course of conduct where there are specific, discrete incidents of misrepresentation.
Yeah, I know you've recited them, and they're in the brief that way, but it's one incident. It's one case, let's say. It's several incidents in one case. And I think when I understood Fireball, in the case that was the predecessor to that, Green, I think, it was, this happens over a period of time with a group of people, with different people, different examples. And that's always what I thought pattern means, as opposed to pattern just within a single incident.
We take it to mean both things, we do have the attorneys where you have 30 clients come forward and say, "Took my money and didn't do it."
Yeah, that's a pattern.
That's definitely a pattern. Then we also have these types of patterns. We see this all the time. You know, maybe the fear is he didn't want to be susceptible to a malpractice action, or, you know, I don't know what his motivation was for this.
Yeah, but what we're talking about is a sanction. And we have said that you will be suspended a certain amount of time, actual time, for a pattern. And you're saying that pattern can be either number of incidents or one incident.
One incident with a sufficient span of time, and, you know, looking at each case on its facts, we read that decision with both things. In any case, the Venice Council has here the
case. We read a couple of things. He had made seven.
part that says that we're going to take a new approach. We have employees. You've got to take a new approach. You've got to file something new or prepare for whatever. So you can't follow enough to succeed. Statements with a written order to file that he continued to try and negotiate a purchase or a restructuring of debt with the Resolute Trust Corporation while the litigation was going on. Is that true? While he was obviously had ignored some sort of court litigation and apparently plan in terms of federal court litigation would probably almost get you another violation. That is, if you sit down with the client and say, we're going to file something that doesn't have any merit at all, we're going to do it by time. I think that's a violation of something. It could be. But apparently, the realistic thing that could be achieved here, or at least just what we thought, was somehow putting together a plan for this family to get this woman off the books of the Resolute Trust Corporation to get it funded and own it and so forth. Was he in fact undertaking that effort while he was failing to undertake the
There's evidence in the record that he was meeting with the directors of the Resolution Trust Corporation after the notice of dismissal conversion. He had tried to find them. I don't think they're simply located. He was trying to convince them to honor the agreement that the banks had originally made with Crestline before Crestline failed and the RTC took over. So there was some evidence of that. I did ask him, both before the hearing and during the hearing, for any evidence he could give us other than his testimony, such as the receipt from Justice Cleveland, and there was no extrinsic evidence whatsoever than just his testimony.
But there is some evidence to that. Now, is it also true that these folks waived off clearing off this debt in bankruptcy, but they remain obligated under this loan?
They reaffirmed the mortgage.
They did that without the office. They did that before he took over.
And before the Resolution Trust Corporation took over Crestline. That was really a complicating factor because then Resolution Trust decided they weren't going to honor Crestline's reaffirmation. And that really wasn't the spot of litigation. So the role, one of the goals of litigation, along with the time at the settlement of the house, was to make Resolution Trust honor the agreement with the president.
Maybe that's not the case because they did not honor that and at the same time seek recovery for the balance, the differential between what was sold and the house program.
It's a very complicated law, but it appears that they can. This is an awesome federal agency with awesome powers, as I've learned in this case. I think that's what they were attempting to do with the benefits.
Okay, so this lawyer took on a client who was in foolishly, perhaps, put themselves in a pretty good home.
Yes. He took it at a very low point in their negotiations with Crestline and RTC.
He said now they're through bankruptcy, so they can't discharge this debt. And we can't get the house.
Right. And they have been forced to leave the house. They already vacated the premises.
When they went to the lawyer.
So it was a very difficult posture. His option at that point, though, was to self-pay. This is an impossible case.
Sad things happen.
Right. But when he took the case, he also, the duty of loyalty kicked in, and all the duties that are enunciated in the he had to represent them properly. And if that meant person went in and said, I'm sorry, but this case, I'm going to have to let this case be dismissed because we just have no legal argument, then that's the appropriate course of action. Not letting it be dismissed in the line of the original house. As you may have mentioned, as someone mentioned earlier, there are elements of neglect in this case. That was part of our complaint. Respondent asserted in his argument that the neglect count was dismissed, and that is not the case. Findings of fact were made. There was just no conclusion of law that there was neglect in this case. I think that the neglect is self-evident. Obviously, the house was sold. But not achieve any of their goals in litigation. The case was dismissed without the ability to refile it for some time because of the precarious factual situation of the case. By the time they found out about it, it was 13 months later, there were new occupants in the house. All the hospitals and the client's attorney, and they testified that they did not find an attorney who would look at this case at that time. We think that those facts, amounting to black, we saw no indication of Zell's representation after the motion to dismiss was filed. And that's reflected in the findings of fact. The count that was dismissed was count two, that was based on failure to respond to the retainer. We did not have any proof that the retainer had been refunded up until just before the hearing. We made a decision not to amend the complaint and simply stand at the hearing and say, we're refunding
the
decision.
The reference on page four to the statute of limitations has passed. That's the action against Crestline, right?
Yes, we believe that was a six-year statute of limitations that passed us. That's what that reference was for. I don't think the 15-year statute of limitations applies in this case. There was no court has been finding which one applies. And with that, we would respectfully ask that you find that this attorney has engaged in a pattern of practice and misrepresentations to his client and sanction him with a year's suspension and 6 months' stay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. You better use your time to make 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just to clarify a couple of factual statements made by the disciplinary counsel. First of all, I asked Mr. Benedict at the hearing, and it's reflected in the record, he admitted right away that he got his retainer back. So I don't know why it was ever alleged from the beginning that his retainer was not refunded to him, and the disciplinary counsel represents they didn't know until the day of the hearing. All he had to do was ask Mr. Benedict. As the court, I'm sure, is aware, the house was sold, title had transferred, the bank had repossessed it, bought it back through the Resolution Trust prior to ever coming to Mr. Waltz. And Mr. Benedict had moved out of the house prior to engaging Mr. Waltz. He had this side agreement that he bought with the bank that applied. It turned out that the officer of the bank that he had the agreement with ended up getting indicted for some kind of fraud in his capacity with the bank, so that even had they pursued the case on the merits, one of their key witnesses was no longer credible. But in spite of that, Your Honor, basically the deficiency judgment against was not taken against Mr. Benedict in this case at the time of the foreclosure, so there was nothing overhanging the head of Mr. Benedict. There was no prejudice to him whatsoever or any monies he might be liable for. And under state law, any deficiency judgment has to be collected within 2 years in any event. So there is no damage to Mr. Benedict or any potential liability of his in this particular case. I think it's important the court understand the facts and that the panel did find that after the motion to dismiss that the respondent in this case did continue actively to try to find a way to win for Mr. Benedict. It wasn't like he did everything up to the motion to dismiss and then all of a sudden laid down. And the panel found that the contra-event was one of the mitigating factors. And I believe, based upon comments of Justice Douglas, that this is not a pattern case. Foul law addressed the case situations of where a lawyer engages in a pattern of dishonesty or a course of conduct with a client, and the court indicated that, in essence, it wanted to teach a lesson to the bar at large who treated dishonesty as a way of life. All the corroborative witnesses from Mr. Wallace indicated this was a purely isolated incident on his part. There was no other evidence to the contrary.
But to this client, this pattern of conduct, this client who lied, I mean, overtly, it wasn't just a matter of not, oh, I forgot to tell you, your case was dismissed, but he sent letters telling him this is the number one priority in my office. You know, to that client, the lawyer has breached the fiduciary duty, and my problem with all this is that when lawyers do that, clients talk, and they form impressions and perceptions about the legal profession, and we call
suffer from that, from the conduct of your client, and we don't seem to be able to get the message to lawyers that if you're dishonest with your clients, there's going to be a penalty, a sanction. It's going to be more than a slap on the wrist. We have to sit out for a while because that seems to be the only way we can get people's attention. And, you know, this isn't the only case. We see a pattern of lawyers lying. Not, you know, still a very small percentage, obviously, very tiny percentage, but it's increasing. We see more and more cases like this. And so somehow we've got to get the message to the bar that when you take that oath of office, being honest is the fundamental principle of being a lawyer. So that's why this case is more than just, you know, lying to a client over a dismissed case. It's a message.
Your Honor, if you take the context of the correspondence that Mr. Donchance referred to, the one document he sent him, he did send him an amended complaint in that particular letter that he sent him.
How could you file an amended complaint to a suit that's been dismissed?
He never filed it, though.
No, he didn't file it.
The client thinks, oh, you're going to file an amended complaint for me. No, it was all bull. To be frank, it's just bull. He just leaves his client alone to let the client think that he's still representing him, and you wonder why people, you know, think that some members of our profession aren't honest.
I understand, Your Honor, and I for one don't want the word lawyer, liar, associate.
I know you don't, and that's not why you're here. I understand that. You're representing a client. You're doing the best you can for it.
But I would point out in this case, Your Honor, that I do believe that the follow-up law can be distinguished on the basis of a pattern issue, of this being a strictly isolated example of other correspondence other than the October 94 letter, which was stipulated to distinguish in that instance.
Thank you. The case is submitted to be advised of our opinion.